Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the JMO Podcast. I'm your host, Taylor Michaels, and our guest this episode, we've got Josh Johnson from Williston, North Dakota, and his home bodies of water these days are Fort Peck in eastern Montana and Lake Sakakawea. And we're going to talk about both of them in this conversation. Last time, having him on and being introduced to him, getting to know him a little bit, he produces some very educational YouTube content. He is very competitive in the tournament fields that he enters into on both bodies of water. And then he guides also, and that is on the side of being a family man and having a full-time job. So, I mean, he's just a hard worker. He doesn't cut any corners. And, you know, he just really, really impressed me with, you know, just his fishing knowledge. He definitely has a sciencey approach to these things. He's a very smart guy. He has that sort of that X factor, if you will, with finding and catching big fish on these reservoirs. And so it's very, very fun to have him back on, and we get caught up a little bit on the fishing he's been doing recently. And yeah, I mean, just a great, great conversation about the summer bite and really trying to pick on the tougher bites that we get out here on these western reservoirs in the midsummer. There can definitely be these, you know, days or weeks or the, you know, just these certain time frames where we have lulls in the bite, whether it's, you know, weather related or, you know, it's just turns out to be that magical time of year where there's so much bait and so much forage in the system that, you know, a lot of these fish are just too full to bite a lure. We've all had those tough days, and Josh does a great job talking about some of the tougher days he's had both on Fort Peck and Sakakawea this year, really contrasting both of them. But really, we get really dialed into Josh's thought process on, you know, just how to find and then what he does, what his recipe for success is, if he can find it on the tougher days. So just a great, great conversation. And we spend a lot of time talking about, you know, the thermocline topic that I probably don't touch on enough on this podcast. So I'm just very excited to have Josh on and definitely do a deep dive into his approach and sort of his interpretation and his experiences with some of these great topics. So tough bites on these western reservoirs. Let's get to it with Josh Johnson. The fishing opportunities across the state of Montana are phenomenal. If you're from there or you've already been there a bunch to experience it, you know just how special these opportunities are. If you haven't, fishing out west should absolutely be on your bucket list. But aquatic invasive species like zebra mussels and Eurasian water milfoil can harm recreational opportunities. As boaters, as anglers, we have the ability to help protect Montana's waters by cleaning all mud, plants and debris off our boat, recreational equipment, and fishing gear before we leave any access sites. Drain the water from your motor, your live well, your bilges, and allow your boat and equipment time to dry before your next outing. No matter what watercraft you use, please, if you're traveling in the state of Montana, stop at all inspection stations. Together, we can protect Montana's waters. Visit the link in the description of this podcast for more information. That's fwp.mt.gov/AIS. Shields is a one-stop shop retailer with all your outdoor needs covered. Shields has all the top brands on inventory in every department and a knowledgeable staff known for great service. With over 30 locations across the country, you can find the nearest store by going online to shields.com. If you can't get to a store, rest assured all their best deals are online as well. So once again, head to shields.com for more detailed information. That link is in the description of this podcast. If you have any fishing memory or a fish that you would like to commemorate with a replica, or you have questions about getting fish replicas done, reach out to Jamie Rizavi from Rizavi Taxidermy Studio in New Rockford, North Dakota. Jamie and his crew do next level work. Here at the JMO headquarters, we are blessed to have so many replicas made by Jamie. Reach out. You can find him on social media or online at rizavitaxidermystudio.com. The link is in the description of this podcast. My man, how is it going over there? I'm guessing the new arrival has something to do with how things are going over at your house.
Yeah, no, it's definitely been a busy season. You know, it's late nights with the baby, then late night friggin' tackle, then late nights with the baby, and a lot of late nights, not a lot of sleep, but it's been good. And our new baby Evie, she's been doing well and
good.
Yeah. So But yeah, had you know, the first first part of the season, you know, I mean, spring and June were definitely a little lower on the fishing end of the spectrum, but then I kind of jumped back into it pretty good starting in July. So
getting into fishing, I mean, and if the vibe is right, man, we can just start right here as long as you're cool with that.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say you just hit record and I mean,
let's do it, man. Let's
just
do it.
Roll with that.
Yeah, so. Dude, I love it. As far as fishing goes, what's kind of been, have you been doing, you know, more content, more guiding, more personal fishing, a couple of tournaments? Like, what's the breakdown been for you here recently?
Well, this year, in terms of the open water season anyways, like I was saying, we had our new baby girl in June. So June was definitely heavy focus on the family, but got back into it with some tournaments and some guiding, fairly heavy come July. And since then, it's been, you know, a lot of, you know, going hard, not sleeping a lot between family life, work life, doing, fitting in some tournaments, fitting in some guiding, you know, just been a very, very busy season. Content, you know, as far as YouTube, stuff like that, I'd say has been relatively non-existent this summer. Hoping to get back into that soon. Just, it's one of those time-intensive things that right now is, my priority is fishing. Content comes after that. I do love teaching people about fishing, so like that is something I'd like to get back to doing. The YouTube thing, I think, is pretty pretty cool avenue for teaching and demonstrating what's going on, and you know, also just kind of promoting the business. But yeah, no. So I've still been at it, just kind of been a different pace in terms of family life and making sure they're taken care of well first. Just, you know, if they're taken care of well at first, then it's easier to focus on fishing when I am fishing. So it's definitely been some back and forth with that.
You fished the Montana Gov Cup?
Yeah, no, that was really my jump back into into fishing after we had our baby girl, the Montana Gov Cup. So it was me and my buddy Cody Rowland. We went from the Montana Gov Cup to the North Dakota Gov Cup. And then it was like, week and a half after that, I jumped into trying my first NWT. It was on Lake Sakakawea, so relatively local. Fished that and, you know, kind of been doing a hodgepodge of guiding, like literally in between tournaments, after tournaments, jumping back and forth between Fort Peck and Lake Sakakawea. So it's been busy.
Yeah, man. How did the Montana Gov Cup go? I'm just curious to get a little Montana update, I guess, overall, like what the summer bite was, or the July bite was on Peck for you?
Well, the Montana Gov Cup, I mean, I would say relative speaking was, it was a very tough fishing tournament. It was a little bit tougher to find fish. It was also really difficult to get them to bite. You know, I wasn't fishing a lot. I did a little bit of fishing in June on Sakakawea. You know, not a lot on either Sakakawea or Peck. As a general rule, it seemed like the bite was kind of off on both. I'd say it's been kind of a weird year. There's a lot of things that could be attributed to. I think a lot of that is honestly, like, June was so cold and so windy that I really think that the water column just got mixed up really super well. And there was really no, like, thermal layers, no thermocline. Like, I think a lot of the fish were really spread out from shallow to deep, and some of the fish that might have kind of trended or migrated upriver, some of those fish hadn't necessarily moved back to the main lake. But then right as like the Montana Gov Cup was about to go down, like literally the week before, it went from like a super windy and cold June with like a water column that was completely mixed, you know, it just really wasn't concentrating fish very well, to then all of a sudden like stupid hot flat calm. So I really think just everything was transitioning so quickly. And on, you know, Fort Peck and Lake Sakakawea, depending on where you're at, they're so bait fish rich that like when those fish don't feel like biting, they just don't eat. It is possible to get them to eat, and people obviously did that. You know, Owen and Gage won first place, you know, they did a good job putting together an awesome day too. Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a tough bite going into it. You know, we were finding, you know, me and my buddy Cody, we were finding fish everywhere from back bays out to, you know, main lake structures out in 45 feet of water. You know, some of the bites were in practice. It was good at times. However, the timing of it, it definitely trended where, like, at least for us personally, like, we weren't doing half bad, but a lot of it was between, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon through the evening, which clearly is not the time for the tournament.
Right.
I mean, you know, so that's one of the biggest things that I've run into this year, as far as like figuring out the timing of the bite can be a really tricky deal. So like for us, day one of the Gov Cup, ultimately, you know, we had a lot of chances. You know, sometimes when the bite's finicky, they start nipping at it. It's easy to lose fish. It's just kind of part of the game. That definitely happened to us day one. In the end, we only landed 2 fish, and I think we were in, like, I don't know, we actually weren't doing half bad. They were 2 of the right fish, let's put it that way. You know, and then the funny thing, so then the next day, we also only landed 2 fish. Once again, 2 of the right fish. It was like a 31.5-inch fish and a 30-inch fish. We were around the right ones, just a matter of getting them to bite is not always easy. But it was really just such a hard tournament for everybody. We ended up in, I think it was like 19th out of 190 some boats. So it didn't look too bad on paper.
Totally.
In terms of what we were personally hoping for, but you know, that's part of fishing and something I've been trying to, learn to grow in, is learning how to lose well. And, you know, congratulate the winners. I use them as inspiration for the next go around and take what you can and learn from that. And, you know, go from there. So,
yeah, I'm curious. I mean, yeah, it's pretty unprecedented when being on a body of water where you can weigh 4 fish out of 10 in a 2-day tournament and be in the top 20. It speaks to the tough bite, but it also just speaks to the caliber of fish that you're on, and you got to be on a body of water that offers that. So we're always promoting Fort Peck because it's such a, you know, there's just giants out there, and that's always part of the conversation. But the tough bite, I think, you know, I can't have enough of these conversations when we're addressing like any time of year, but like, it seems like out on these Western reservoirs, that summertime when there's so, you know, the point you made is a point I like to make, is that if you come out here for the first time and you're fishing Sakakawea or Fort Peck, and your first look at it, you know, if you're from somewhere else, it's like mid July, you know, it's astounding how much food is in the system. And that's obviously a factor for, you know, where the fish are going to be and how, what their behavior is going to be like. I'm curious to kind of dig into that a little bit. You know, and this is sort of a transferable topic. I feel like, you know, whichever, you know, Sakakawea or Fort Peck, where you spend most of your time fishing, whichever one is the better example in your mind. But when you're addressing that tough summer bite, you know, sometimes it's day to day, you know, sometimes it's just, you know, one day you're a hero, the next day you're a zero. Like, but on the days that it's tougher, you know, or even in a tournament scenario or a non-tournament scenario, again, just whatever you feel like is the best description, but like, you know, how do you address those tough bites? Do you try to grind where you feel like you already know you're around good fish? Do you try to force feed them something? Do you do things? Do you have a progression of things to try to get those tough fish to bite? Or do you more so cover ground and just try to contact as many fish as possible? I'd like to just kind of hear, you know, the bites you do get, or, you know, not just the bites, you know, you're referring to, but just in your whole career, you know, year in and year out fishing these bodies of water the way you do, what do you feel like can sometimes be the recipe for success under these tough summer conditions that seem like they always happen right in that, in, you know, that July or whenever, you know, whenever that first little hot swing happens, you know, and the bait fish just become that perfect size where the walleyes are just every predator fish out there is just literally swimming through walls. It's like blinding walls of bait fish.
Yeah, and on both Fort Peck and then especially like the east half of Sakakawea, you run into that with smelt. And personally, I usually love fishing like July and August, which is kind of ironic because that's when we started, you know, when the water got hot is actually kind of when it got, you know, really tough there for a bit. But anyways, as far as like, you know, my approach, I guess the short answer is I'm definitely on the run and gun program. In terms of like covering more water, getting my bait in front of more fish. Personally, I believe there's some fish that, you know, even in a tough bite will bite. And it almost, it's going to sound dumb, but sometimes it doesn't even matter what it is. Like it just happens like the right time, the right fish, the right place, they're going to bite. And if you, I mean, there's multiple strategies that can work. But definitely I leave a lot of fish to find fish. You know, I would say like, I almost get anxiety if I'm on a spot for more than 15, 20 minutes sometimes, you know, kind of a joke, but you know, at the same point, like, I personally fish, I feel like fish my best, and my buddy Cody tends to be the way that way too, where, we definitely prefer to run and gun, get our baits in front of more fish. That being said, something that, you know, has really come to light, which this has always been the case, but something that like I really emphasize, and especially in, you know, today's day and age with forward facing sonar, stuff like that. I feel like, you know, some tips that I could give people to try to keep things simple, to approaching any bite, whether it's a tough bite or a good bite that you just want to turn into a great bite. You know, I think it's important to really test a few different things. Number one, do the fish want the bait below them or above them? And do they want more of a reactionary style bite, or do they want more of a subtle presentation? For example, like in the case of walleye, you know, something like a glide bait. To me, that's more of a bottom style presentation. It can be worked overhead of the fish and can work really well. That being said, for me, I kind of prefer it more of a, as a bottom style presentation, where I'm letting that bait rip right past the fish. And it's also like a reactionary style bite. So it's a bottom style presentation and a reactionary style presentation, where if you're looking for something that, you know, for example, you know, so like to have like a bottom style presentation and then to have something that you can work overhead of the fish. So for example, something you could work overhead of the fish, that would be more of a reactionary style presentation, would be something like a jerk bait. You know, you can work it overhead of the fish, you can work it real erratically to trigger a bite. And then something else, you know, to keep in mind as far as the other category of bait would be something that's subtle. Take for example, a jig and crawler. Now a jig and crawler, you can pitch it out, tight line it, work it over the head of the fish, or drop it below the fish. So you could work it on bottom or overhead of the fish, but it's a subtle presentation. So like something that I, you know, really try to emphasize with people, like when I'm guiding and just trying to teach people, etc., is to really focus on those categories. Something you can work below the fish, something you can work above the fish, something that's a reactionary style presentation, and something that's a subtle style presentation. So like I'd say on average, you almost really kind of want 3-4 presentations handy. And at that point you can try to like, you know, see how the fish is set up, how the fish is reacting. So like, I guess what I'm saying is during a tough bite, I'm trying to cover as much water as possible, but I'm still trying to probe those different categories of baits to see like, you know, that I'm not just getting stuck on a glide bait all day long when like maybe you could work a bait like a jig and crawler overhead and maybe they'd start chewing the thing. So like, I think you want to work as quickly as possible, cover as much water as possible while testing the waters of those, you know, a bottom presentation, an overhead presentation, a reaction presentation, and a subtle presentation. So that's kind of my recipe, is to like test the waters with those while cycling spots as quickly as possible, which isn't easy to do, especially when you don't have a lot of targets. Like for example, on peck, sometimes you have a limited amount of targets. So you're really having to make snap decisions about what you're going to throw, because a lot of times your first cast is your best cast. You don't want to mess it up. You want to select the correct item, you know, but a lot of times, you know, if I throw at two fish that I think are like, yeah, these are big walleye and they don't react at all, I'm usually trying to switch presentations in some way, shape or form.
The fishing opportunities across the state of Montana are phenomenal. If you're from there or you've already been there a bunch to experience it, you know just how special these opportunities are. If you haven't, fishing out west should absolutely be on your bucket list. But aquatic invasive species like zebra mussels and Eurasian water milfoil can harm recreational opportunities. As boaters, as anglers, we have the ability to help protect Montana's waters by cleaning all mud, plants and debris off our boat, recreational equipment, and fishing gear before we leave any access sites. Drain the water from your motor, your live well, your bilges, and allow your boat and equipment time to dry before your next outing. No matter what watercraft you use, please, if you're traveling in the state of Montana, stop at all inspection stations. Together, we can protect Montana's waters. Visit the link in the description of this podcast for more information. That's fwp.mt.gov/AIS. Shields is a one-stop shop retailer with all your outdoor needs covered. Shields has all the top brands on inventory in every department and a knowledgeable staff known for great service. With over 30 locations across the country, you can find the nearest store by going online to shields.com. If you can't get to a store, rest assured all their best deals are online as well. So once again, head to shields.com for more detailed information. That link is in the description of this podcast. If you have any fishing memory or a fish that you would like to commemorate with a replica, or you have questions about getting fish replicas done, reach out to Jamie Rizavi from Rizavi Taxidermy Studio in New Rockford, North Dakota. Jamie and his crew do next level work here at the JMO headquarters. We are blessed to have so many replicas made by Jamie. Reach out. You can find him on social media or online at RizaviTaxidermyStudio.com. The link is in the description of this podcast.
Yeah, and how often do you see like a trend that sticks? I mean, as anglers, we're all looking for some type of a pattern. We want to build confidence in something that we can take from fish to fish. Do you feel like, I mean, I feel like definitely kind of it goes without saying in some ways, like, you know, being versatile with every single fish, especially when you're talking forward sonar and you're like hunting down like individual fish, like being versatile every fish is a good thing ultimately. But like on those tougher bites, like how often, you know, after a couple of fish, do you start to feel like, okay, jigging a crawler is going to be the thing more so today? Or are you just trying to keep that out of your head? So, and you just keep every fish objective.
One thing I'd say on a lot of tough bites, something that personally makes it tough, like something that I excel at is like when I can get on a pattern, I can run that pattern and run it so fast, cover so much water, contact so many fish that I feel like I can just start wrecking the fish. To me, something that makes it a tough bite is the difficult to predict what they're going to eat and like difficult to pattern a bite. So I'd say like in a lot of those tough bite situations, you almost have to, it's frustrating because you almost have to treat every fish differently, but yet it's like, sometimes it doesn't even make sense because the fish will be positioned similarly, doing similar things, and yet they go for what appears to be completely different things. And that's, to me personally, something that makes it a very tough bite. That being said, so like, for example, on Sakakawea, during both the North Dakota Gov Cup, you know, and then leading up to like the NWTOs fishing, stuff like that. Something that we found that was pretty interesting. So personally, when you were like, what I was noticing, and this could change, but this was something that I found personally, like when we were around like gluts of smelt, especially further east, glide baits were very hit and miss at best. I'd say very missed, like not working very well. It seemed like if you got away from, you know, as heavy concentrations of smelt, glide baits started working better. But it was interesting because, for example, what we started noticing was fish that, like, for example, on forward facing were like literally a foot or 2 foot off bottom, not around smelt, were responding extremely well to glide baits. So what we started to notice and started, this was something we were able to start patterning, was those fish that were within like 2 foot of bottom were responding to glide baits super well. Like the conversion rate was very good. But if that fish was even like 3-4 foot off bottom, there was something about glide baits where like occasionally they would work, but like the conversion rate just dropped like crazy. And it's kind of bizarre because honestly on peck, a lot of those fish that are like 5-6 foot off bottom, dude, they'll just chow a glide bait. That's like what you're looking for. But like on Sakakawea, you wanted the fish to be visible off bottom, but that was about it. And if it was any higher than that, it seemed like it was actually much more productive to throw like a jerk bait, jig and crawler, or like I was throwing kind of like a, it's a homemade version of kind of like a, I forget what they're, like the Callan search bait style, you know, the spinner death rig style, the death jig, castable death jig type deal. So it seemed like if those fish were any further than like 3 foot off bottom, you really had to fish a bait overhead. You know, so that was something we noticed. So it was very interesting because, like, depending on the bait fish you're around, like if you're on tons of smelt, it seemed much more productive to fish crawlers of some variety, whether it was a jig and crawler, a spinner, casting a jig, spinner, and crawler, or fishing a jerk bait. Or if I got into areas that had a lower density of smelt, a higher concentration of emerald shiners, fish closer to the bottom, they would respond really well to a glide bait, or if they're up high, really good to a jerk bait. But yeah, that was just a few observations that we ran into that, like, we were able to start patterning. Now, it wasn't necessarily always easy. And the tricky thing about it, like, as far as the tournament goes, is day to day, the bait fish would kind of like change position, shift around. So like an area that might not have had a lot of smelt, next thing you know, you show up there in the tournament expecting it to look one way, and it's just like over, like just riddled with smelt. Fish aren't really responding the way you think they should, etc. So
yeah,
like a lot of times you had to be really spontaneous in terms of your spots, you know, which was something that I could have maybe done a little bit better on, because like even for the NWT, I got really focused on a particular area where like I was trying to find like the biggest fish in the lake. I mean, you know, you're going into a tournament, obviously you're trying to find the biggest fish, but like, you know, there was quite a few fish that were in like the, you know, quite a few 2 to 3 pounders, and then quite a few 4.5s, but like the tournament fish that you're really going to probably be looking for were like 25 to 26 inches, and they're in the 5 pound range on average. So I was looking to see if I could find fish bigger than that. I told my buddy, I was like, dude, like I found some like Fort Peck caliber fish here. This is going to be sick. Like if I can get these things to bite, this is going to be crazy. I did catch a couple in practice. They were huge. And like just fish that I don't catch on Sakakawea, to be honest. Like I've never caught fish like that. That being said, I kind of threw, I think, too many of my eggs in one basket. So instead of just having tons of areas where I might be able to convert 5 pounders, I was kind of looking to see if there's areas where I could convert like those 7 to 10 pounders. But ultimately, like the way the bait fish was switching around, things like that, like it's hard to rely on a single spot like that or a single region. And I had more than one region, but like ultimately that kind of bit me a little bit because like day two, those fish just got really weird. I think if I'd focus a little bit less on like finding the like biggest fish in the system and more on just finding quality fish everywhere, it would have probably done me better. So anyways, not sure if that answered all your questions there.
Dude, I respect you found some big fish and you put your eggs in that basket, man. I can respect that. Like, how do you put the work in and find some big fish and not put your eggs in that basket, man? That'd be my question. Come on, brother. I love that. Yeah. You know, cause you know what, if it worked out for you, man, you'd have been an absolute hero. So, you know, from the sounds of it. So, dude, you don't even have to be bummed about that. I get a kick out of that, dude. I would have died on that hill for sure too, man. If I got like one huge bite at pre-fishing for a tournament like that, I'd be like, yep, this is where I'm going. Oh man. Yeah, man. So, you know, what else, man? Like, I just kind of like that the conversation, you know, that kind of revolves around this, you know, and I like that you're kind of one of these guys that I can have contrast like Fort Peck and Sakakawea too, because you definitely, you know, through the lens of, you know, like your style of fishing, again, is just something that I'm really intrigued by. And it's definitely something that I learn a lot from. And Sakakawea and Peck are two of my favorite bodies of water. So contrasting them, and they are very different. That's probably doesn't get said maybe enough. They're on the Missouri River system and they're in proximity of each other, you know, geographically, and but definitely different forage, which definitely has a big impact on where or how you're going to find fish. And then of course the fish population there, you know, the fish distribution, or, you know, the size structure anyways, and the age classes is definitely different. I mean, you know, so any stories along those lines, but you know, since those tournaments, has the bite picked up for you? Have you been out on Peck since?
Yeah, no, I mean, I've been back there. It's been a hodgepodge of really good fishing. I mean, also multi-species fishing between walleye, smallmouth, lake trout. So, you know, there's been kind of a hodgepodge. So I can't even speak to one species as much as just kind of like the overall bite. But, you know, I just got off a few days out there guiding, doing some walleye, some lakers, and had a couple days with a buddy fishing smallmouth, and yeah, I mean, all three of which, all three species were biting, you know, really quite well overall considering, I mean, there's always going to be moments at peck where it's not quite, you know, jiving, but, just got done fishing some smallies, and honestly, those are one of my favorites and had a blast doing that. And, as far as, if you want to talk about like comparing and contrasting Sakakwe and Fort Peck in general, a couple things that so something that I seek a lot, which people that, fish with me will start to realize, is like, I'm not just out there to figure out like what the fish are doing, but like why the fish are doing that. So I'm very interested in studying the body water itself, the bait fish. I mean, like, I'm curious about like lengths of the Cisco on Fort Peck during July, one year to the next, what the thermoclines are, things like that. Anyways, so like, I definitely try to study them as much as possible. When it comes to Fort Peck, I would say that like the fishery very much revolves around Cisco. They eat some other stuff. They eat perch, they eat spot-tail shiners, they eat young of the year, etc. There's perch out. When I first started fishing out there years ago, there was quite a few perch. They'll eat young of the year crappie, but really day in, day out, it revolves around big fish pounding Cisco. For the most part with that, you're just looking for mostly offshore structure related to deeper water, because Cisco, they're a cool water bait fish, and like especially come summertime, they're going to be related to water below the thermocline. So like, you need structures that are adjacent to the thermocline for, you know, those that have mass quantities of smelt nearby. Now, Cisco, if you're on Fort Peck, the Cisco and like then on Sakakwe, the smelt, both of those are cool water bait fish. They tend to relate to water below the thermocline, but there's different times during the day where they will make movements above the thermocline to feed. Cisco, they tend to do that much more often. You'll tend to find them much shallower at times, and just making like little flurries through the shallows much more commonly than smelt will this time of the year, for example. So like Fort Peck, you can definitely run into shallow walleye bites you're shallow but related to deeper water. Like you might be in 10 to 25 foot, but you might be a cast from 60 foot of water. Where Sakakwe, the most prevalent cool water bait fish is smelt, and the smelt, they tend to hang below the thermocline, but they're much more light sensitive. They tend to like just stay down there. They don't seem to make flurries up shallow as often. So when you're looking for big fish on Sakakwe, you're generally related to the thermocline, and there's not as much of a shallow and deep bite for fish that are related specifically to smelt. The fish that are specifically related to smelt on Sakakwe are going to be right adjacent to the thermocline, right on that ledge, right before it's going to break off in the deep water where the smelt are. That being said, on, Sakakwe, there still is a lot of really good shallow bites, but a lot of them are related to emerald shiners, young of the year white bass. There's a few perch here and there. So you can get on shallow bites, but it seems like on Sakakwe, when you're around a bunch of smelt, if the smelt aren't super deep yet, which is usually related to the thermocline. So like, let's say you have a thermocline in 35 foot of water, that's not super deep. So you're going to have a higher concentration of big walleye out to 35 foot of water. So like there's less of like a bite in 20 foot and less. It's usually concentrated closer to the deep thermocline, where if that thermocline was to move even deeper, like let's just say 65 foot of water, it seems like some of the walleye just don't want to deal with that deep water. So you'll actually almost get, in my opinion, a better shallow water bite, because they start relating more to shiners, things like that. So like when you are around a bunch of smelt, if they're not too deep, you're usually wanting to fish adjacent to them on that structure, just, one ledge shallower than the smelt are sitting at. But if those smelt move super deep, you're going to have to either move super deep with a smelt or move super shallow and look for emerald shiners, young of the year white bass, stuff like that, that they might be feeding on.
That makes a ton of sense. And that explains a lot of, there's definitely a shallow bite all the time on Sakakwe.
Yep.
But I like the way you define that for sure. Because, you know, I think that a lot of people, you know, light bulb will go off for a lot of people that fish the Kakawea in that way, you know, or at least validate, you know, what people experience out there on PEC in an area, like in a tournament scenario, when you're putting together an area, you know, where there's quality fish and that's where you're going to spend your time in that region to fish a tournament. Like, do you, I mean, throughout the day, like, is there things you can kind of predict, or do you literally just get that trolling motor and you're traveling from 30 feet up to 10 feet back down to 30 feet? Like, how are you like covering water to find fish?
Yeah, no, I mean, ultimately, no matter what, you're putting the trolling motor in the water and you're covering water, whether you're idling spots, you know, I mean, like if I'm pre-fishing tournament with my buddy Cody, I mean, a lot of times we'll just put the motor in gear and, for example, one person's idling watching side scan 2D while the other person is up front, literally panning the, you know, forward facing, just like we're moving 3 miles an hour covering structure. So ultimately fish are where you find them. There's no set science to the whole thing. I try to look for kind of the science behind it, but ultimately like they are where they are. If you can find a thermocline, it is very, especially if it's like, and this is difficult to like know if you haven't been there much, but like if it's kind of established and been stable, you can kind of start predicting what kind of structures the fish are going to be on just by finding the thermocline alone. If it's a shallow thermocline, like let's just say 30 foot, most of your walleye are going to be 30 foot and shallower. Most of your siskar are going to be 30 foot and deeper with, you know, the occasional coming up shallower to feed, obviously. So like a thermocline can really isolate that. And the deeper your thermocline is and the longer it's been deeper, the more likely those fish are to move to offshore structure. So like, let's just say there's been a thermocline out in 45 foot of water or deeper for a week straight. There's a high likelihood that a lot of those fish are going to be way offshore, or like even on offshore humps, things like that, especially if the thermocline's out in like 60 foot. And a lot of the bigger fish on PEC, in my opinion, are usually going to be from the thermocline and then that next ledge or two shallower. But really like what I'm looking for with that, not only just depth, but like where they're at in proximity to the bank, because like if you have a 30 foot thermocline, that's relatively shallow on PEC. And, you know, most of those fish are going to be relating pretty close to like shorelines. Like they might be on inside turns of points, things like that, or like points that aren't necessarily like a mile offshore. So that is one thing that I definitely use to try to like eliminate water more quickly, or to predict, like even in a tournament, like if I get out there at the beginning of the week and I see deep thermoclines and I'm finding fish closer to the bank, I'm kind of expecting that they're slowly working their way out. That being said, if you have a wind event and it stirs the water up, you know, that definitely might bring a thermocline up in some areas or down in some areas. And I'm kind of like looking for that to happen and predicting that the fish might be shifting, and particularly in those zones, you know. So, and actually back to that same deal. So it's kind of interesting. So like even during the NWT, the area that I was originally looking to fish, the thermocline was about 45 foot of water leading up to the tournament. And the interesting thing, the deeper the thermocline was, the less time it seemed like the fish would spend chowing on smelt in the mornings, and the quicker they would move up and just kind of chill on structure. So what I was targeting was like isolated giant fish in like this low density area. There wasn't, I mean, earlier, especially there wasn't many walleye around, but like, it seemed like the deeper the thermocline was, the less time they'd spend feeding on smelt in the morning, the sooner that they'd push up on structure. And then you'd have like these isolated big fish that were just kind of like resting, to be honest, but they weren't in the middle of feeding on smelt, so you could get their attention much easier. And the interesting thing was like the night before day two of the NWT, we had this strong east wind, and it actually upwelled the thermocline in the area that where I was fishing, where like that thermocline went from like 45 foot to 36 foot. And those big fish that I've been trying to fish for that would like, you know, get off the smelt a little bit quicker, were feeding on those smelts hard like all day. So like they really never moved up on that structure where I was able to like more efficiently target them. Didn't have many backup plans and fell apart, but just kind of an interesting scenario that happened.
So. Oh yeah, that is super interesting. I like the way you describe that. Like I'm definitely going to you know, be observant of that moving forward, the way you talk about like a wind event. Cause yeah, like when, you know, stable weather is gonna stabilize the thermocline, right? And then you talk about it's ultimately ends up being a wind event, or maybe just like a cold front, like a, you know, a cold front, which we can have too. But you know, when a wind event, if the fish have been deep and there's a wind event and there's a possibility, or you get out there and you observe a thermocline that's risen up, like those deeper fish might give you an opportunity a little shallower. But if you are experiencing, you know, days and days of stable weather and you see that thermocline setting up a little bit deeper and establishing itself, you might have fish that are set up on structure or set up in some way, and they might be transitioning themselves a little deeper the next day and the next day. I could definitely use that information for sure. I could definitely see how that would be very, very
useful. Yeah, I really think that's one of the most, like, I don't know, I don't want to say overlooked, but like, I think that those thermal layers, I think, really tend to concentrate. And the things that tend to make, I think, sometimes walleye or the cold water bait fish, et cetera, like kind of come and go. I mean, it can be for a million reasons, but those like kind of the changes in those thermal layers really change their position a lot in terms of like where they are offshore, what depth they're sitting in. You know, it can be fairly predictable, but then again, like the thing that I like the least right before like a fishing day is like when there's big wind, because it starts switching all that around. And sometimes it's like fairly predictable, but sometimes it does things that I wouldn't expect. Other times it doesn't really seem to change anything, but,
yeah, cause there's more factors than that too, right? I mean, you know, a guy's got to realize that there's, you know, like it's an entire recipe of like where these fish like are more comfortable in the water and all that sort of thing. Plus the, you know, the food scenario and maybe what it does to watercolor. You know, there's obviously plenty of variables, for when you're scratching your head, you know, but I like the way you say that for sure. Like, you know, like for somebody, cause I guess I feel like I've had conversations about, you know, summertime fishing, thermoclines and pelagic bait, you know, and just finding big fish of any species, but, you know, talking big walleyes, I've definitely feel like I've had plenty of guys talk about, you know, get out there, learn how to find a thermocline with your electronics and use that information to kind of start looking. But the way you describe it, like day to day, like if you just showed up somewhere and started looking for fish, you know, looking at yesterday or 2 days ago weather, you know, before you get somewhere, you know, that's where this kind of information might start really, really benefiting you, because just, you know, just starting to look at or slightly above a thermocline and good looking structure in and around there, you know, that you might strike out and you might just think it's a bunch of hogwash. And, but what you may not be realizing is that, you know, that thermocline that you find that day or the first day of your trip, it might not have necessarily been exactly like that for the last 3 days or for the last 3 weeks. And those fish are transitioning. They're just not set up exactly the way we think they should be yet. And so, you know, just being more, a little bit more open-minded in that regard. I really, really appreciate the way you describe that, man.
Yeah, and a couple things to point out, too. I'm not an expert on thermoclines, but I've been kind of obsessing about them the last few years. Just, like, really watching how it plays into, like, the fishing, because it does. And just to clear up a couple things. So, like, something I commonly hear from people is, like, there's no oxygen below the thermocline. And in some instances, there can be no oxygen. But, like, especially on Fort Peck and Sakakawea, the lakes are well mixed. There's a lot of current. So like there is oxygen below the thermocline. Like for example, like those cool water bait fish that are seeking refuge below the thermocline, if there wasn't oxygen down there, they would die.
Yeah. They wouldn't be there.
Clearly, yeah, lake trout, the salmon, I mean, everything. Generally speaking, your walleye, smallmouth are going to typically be at or above the thermocline. I do think there's exceptions where they will dive down below the thermocline. I feel like I was watching it happen on Sakakawea recently. And the interesting thing was that like there was this thermal layer, like even in the last couple of weeks that set up, like when it was really hot and calm, where like the water was super mixed leading up to like the end of North Dakota Gov Cup. And at first we were finding some fish super deep. Well, they actually started moving shallower, ironically, as the water got hotter, because there was a thermocline setting up shallower, like to start the week. I was dropping a temperature gauge down there and everything. I couldn't really find a thermocline, and I was finding walleye out to like 45 foot. Well, it was a matter of a few days later, we started seeing this little bit of fuzz on our graph in like the 30 some foot range. And it seemed to really start isolating those fish kind of that mid 30 some foot range and a little bit shallower. So it was kind of interesting because like actually as the weather got hotter, a thermocline started setting up and it actually moved the fish shallower, where a lot of times you think as the water gets hotter, they move deeper, but kind of the opposite was happening. But ultimately, I'd say one of the big things to keep in mind is like, as far as like just a quick and dirty way to like even have an idea where the thermocline is setting up, if you're graphing out over deep water, especially if you're like graphing out over smelt, Cisco will be similar too, but Cisco, you'll see lots of groups above the thermocline, but you'll tend to see mass quantities below the thermocline. So like if you're ever graphing out off a ledge where like, let's just say it drops from 30 out into the river channel, it's like 120 foot of water. You'll notice like the bait almost has like a ceiling above it. And that's usually where the thermocline's at. So like, instead of having to spend your whole day dropping like temperature probes down, a lot of times you can just observe that. And a lot of times, not all the time, but a lot of times your biggest fish are going to be just that one ledge shallower than those bait fish are at. So let's just say there's a bait fish, you know, the bait fish come up pretty solid to about 36 foot of water. And like you can, like on Sakakawea, it'll almost look like a ceiling. Like you'll be on certain structures and like the smelt, like even just recently, like they'd towards the east end, they'd come up to like 36 foot of water. And it was like they almost didn't come above it. And a lot of times you'd see walleye suspended just above the bait fish. Well, they were actually suspended right at the thermocline, and the smelt were suspended just below the thermocline. They're just waiting for smelt to shoot up through, and they're ready to grab them. Yeah. You know, but ultimately, like looking for that thermocline, if you just like look for like the level that like that group of bait fish is like most heavily concentrated at, and you fish one ledge shallower, you know, that can be a pretty quick and dirty way to get a big fish.
And I mean the average, you know, there's just so many nice fish right now. Like Sakakawea is just full of you know, those 3 to 4 pound fish, and those fish, I mean, like they're already, you know, if they're living out on the main lake, I mean, that's the, you know, it doesn't take a 10 pounder to gun down these pelagic bait. I mean, that's like once they hit that like 20 inch range.
And that actually made it a little bit tricky for even for tournament fishing, because you really got to be, you know, picky, because like it seems like on Fort Peck, it's much easier to kind of separate yourself in terms of like big fish territory versus little fish territory. You can have areas that are mixed, but on Sakakawea, it is much more difficult to separate yourself in terms of like getting on big fish exclusively. I'd say it's dramatically harder. You know, just a lot of little fish in the system. I don't know what it is, but like,
well, little is relative though, right? I mean, because
yes, correct. I mean, because
if you're not fishing a tournament, a 3-pounder, I mean, yeah, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. So, if you're not fishing a tournament, you're there for like a 3-4 day fishing trip, you know, and you know you're heading out there for a fishing trip and you're camping or whatever, and you spend 3-4 days putting a pattern together on, you know, an average of 3 pounders or 3.5 pounders, you're killing it. I mean, that's how good it is.
I should emphasize. So,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's all relative, because a lot of what I'm referencing is like in terms of like a tournament where you're like trying to catch 5 pounders. But like there's nothing wrong with just having a blast catching a pile of 2 to 3 pounders and then the occasional 5. And, you know, honestly, like, over my years fishing Sakakawea, that's predominantly what I've done. Is like I've never really done that much big fish hunting. I haven't done that many tournaments on Sakakawea. So it's kind of a interesting change of pace to like try to specifically target larger fish. Because, I mean, honestly, in the past, if I was going to go target big fish, I'm just going to go to Fort Peck. Like, I mean, I'm talking like giants. Like if you want a 10-pounder, you know, I mean, if you just want to go and have a blast, you know, I just, you know, especially that section between like, you know, Newtown and Van Hook, I mean, just absurd fun. I mean, just, you know, the water's a little off color, lots of shallow bites. I mean, just stupid fun fishing. I don't want to emphasize Sakakawea is a tough fishery, because, I mean, it can be. But if you're in the right zones, I mean, talk about fun and, like, a really great way to test a lot of techniques, learn a lot. You can go back and forth between shallow bites where fish are schooled up on emerald shiners to, like, deep suspended bites and everything in between. It's a great way you can go for, I mean, you can rig, you can troll cranks. Trolling cranks is such a deadly technique on Sakakawea. I mean, you can do everything. It's such a great place to learn and try a lot of techniques. So yes, keep it all in perspective here when I am talking about a tough fish.
Oh, but yeah. Yeah. No, it's great though. I mean, yeah, it's no secret. You're a big fish hound. So I like the way you talk about fishing, but yeah, it's definitely a point to make. But, maybe this is like a more closing topic, but you know, again, everything that we're talking about here, we're looking for, you know, the above average fish. We're trying to, you know, catch big fish out on these Western reservoirs. You're a forward sonar guy. You're a caster, you know, but you're versatile with your bait selections. You know, we're talking about all that stuff. You know, maybe to get into a little bit of gear here, I want to pick your brain on when you are targeting fish that are, say, 25 feet and deeper, you know, making an accurate cast and, sure, you know, in say adverse conditions, I'm not talking a howitzer wind here, something that's more relatable to everybody. Like everybody probably knows how to, you know, fish in a 10 mile an hour wind, but even a 10 mile an hour wind can throw, you know, a quarter ounce jig, in a crawler or whatever. So I'm curious about gear selection for you to be proficient in those moments where fish are a little bit deeper and you're concerned about fall rates and how much these fish are moving and you know, how many casts you got to make. And what are some of the things with your gear selection? I'm thinking like line, jig size, and just how you, you know, choose those moments when it's the right time to make a cast.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess I would just say, like, ultimately the lure you can get down the fastest in front of the most fish, if they're going to eat it, that's going to be the best bait you can use. To me, in the summertime, that's a glide bait. If they'll eat a glide bait, the only downfall is, I mean, I really think the landing percentage is good. However, it's not as good as some other baits. But other than that, as far as like just overall efficiency, I would definitely err towards like whatever bait drops the fastest is the most aggressive. You can get in front of the most fish, and then to scale back from there, because if you're trying to fish an 8 ounce chicken crawler in 35 foot of water, you're going to have to like play the current. You're going to have to watch that thing fall for, I don't know, 60 seconds. You're hoping that fish doesn't move. There is periods during the day where like fish are like kind of actively feeding and they are definitely moving and grooving, and it's very hard to get a bait down to them efficiently. So like a lot of those, like some of those live bait options just may not be great options to cast at all. You might have to experiment more with like glide baits, but looking at how you retrieve them, whether it's overhead, whether it's on bottom, whether you're slowing the descent, how you're, you know, snapping the bait, things like that, because ultimately if you can't get the bait in front of the fish, you're not going to catch them. But yeah, I would definitely start as aggressive as you can and then kind of scale back from there as necessary. You know, that would be my approach. My approach is start as aggressive and big as possible and then start scaling back from there. You know, the most efficient you can be, the most cast, you know, bigger baits, reaction baits, I feel personally are a little bit better at triggering bigger fish. So that's usually where I'm going to start. And then I'm going to, like, if I need to at some point, scale back to slower, more methodical presentations from there.
What's the most finessey setup you feel like you are comfortable with when you're targeting fish on these reservoirs that are, you know, six plus pounders?
I forget the exact diameters of the line, but like 8 pound fluorocarbon and an 8 ounce jig and crawler and 35 foot of water could be an option. You know, I mean, I really think you could fish as light as you want. I mean, you could fish 4 pound line. I mean, you're gonna do a lot more dancing around. You're gonna be less efficient. It's gonna take longer to get the fish in the boat. But there, I mean, if you have the right rod, reel, line, you know, and have that balance to like protect your line, you can go as light as you want. I mean, you know, I don't think there's a lot of reason to go light on your line unless it's like inhibiting the action of your bait. I don't think many fish are that line shy. Like, yes, I'm using long fluorocarbon leaders, I do believe that to an extent fish are line shy. Like, I'm not going to throw a black steel leader on there. Right. You know, I'm not going to have bright chartreuse line going all the way down to my jig. But, I, you know, the difference between 12-pound fluorocarbon and 8-pound fluorocarbon isn't a lot. So if it's not impeding the action of your bait. Now, the lighter you're fishing, the more finesse you're fishing, the lighter you might want to drop down and kind of match your line to your bait. But personally, I would use as heavy as line as you can get away with. You know, more often than not, I'm using 8-pound fluorocarbon on the light end. You know, I mean, I'm using 15, 20-pound fluorocarbon. I mean, during the Fort Peck Gov Cup, day two, two of the fish that I caught came on a bait casting rod, 7.5-foot long, heavy action with 20-pound braid and 20-pound fluorocarbon and a 7-inch long bait. I mean, so, and the funny thing about that, too, that was like during a tough bite. And that's something else to emphasize is like changing the size of your bait can really change the reaction of the bait too, because of the fish. I mean, because like there was a couple instances, like one of them, we had a 31.5-inch fish. We threw quite a few glide baits at that fish. No reaction. Threw a 7-inch bait at the fish. It was an 1.5-ounce Nishini lure work smelted with a 7-inch long Lunker City finesse fish on it. First cast, swims on down, eats it, jacked the thing, got her in the boat, you know, 20 seconds later. Just like that. But yeah, no, I mean, we cover the whole spectrum and, you know, just kind of matching the rod reel line to your bait, having that all balanced. And I mean, you could fish anything from 4-pound to 20 plus pound, just kind of depends on your presentation.
I like the way you say that, you know, you know, for you anyways, like there's no real reason to scale back on your line size or line diameter unless it impedes the action of your bait. I feel like that's a really good philosophy that it doesn't get articulated quite like that very often. I think that's a great way to look at that.
Yeah. I mean, there's no point in retying more often than you need to, or having to baby fish more than you need to. And like, personally, the number one reason fish are lost is because people aren't playing them hard enough sometimes. Now, once again, it's all a balance. You know, I mean, if you have a fine wire hook, 4-pound line, you're not going to like reef the things in, but like ultimately I feel like you want to fight the fish as hard as you reasonably can. The longer they're fighting, the longer they you know, the better, the more times they have a chance to shake the hook, in my opinion. Not that you need to like reel them straight in and boat flip them, but like, you know, I personally feel like a lot of, you know, more people err on not fighting the fish hard enough, which actually causes fish to get off more than if you were fighting them a little bit harder than you might be comfortable with.
Josh, man, I love it. I love the conversation. I love the thermocline conversation. I know that you have that fishy mind in you that I like tapping into, and you know, just how you observe and interpret things on these reservoirs out here with, you know, in relation to the thermocline and the pelagic bait that we have in these two big bodies of water that we have out here. I like it. I think that, you know, being able to contrast both of them too definitely paints a good picture. I think you probably, you know, you could probably say that by fishing both of them, you learn more about both of them. If a guy only fished Fort Peck, you know, for his whole life, you know, fishing other bodies of water gives you that perspective a little bit, I feel like. And
yeah, no, for sure.
Yeah, no, man, I like that, man. Well, I appreciate it, Josh. Yeah, timing is really good, dude. We've covered all kinds of great things, dude. You definitely got my wheels spinning. I wish I could have the last month of on Sakakawea back, because I had some decent days, but I had some good days that I wish I could have turned into great days. I should have had you in the boat. I should have called you.
Well, you'll have to do that sometime.
I will. Dang, dude. But yeah, dude. Well, I'm glad that everything's going good at home. You got the little one there you're taking care of, and you're getting back in the boat, and we're talking about the fishing, man. I love it. And yeah, dude, I just appreciate the time, and these conversations are always good. I get a lot out of them. So that being said, unless you really wanted to hit anything else, I just wanted to get caught up with you like this and talk about the fishing that you've been having, and just some of your breakdowns and philosophies on this time of year on these reservoirs. And we've definitely done that. So, you know, if there's nothing else, I would just say once again, thank you, and promote yourself. If anybody wants to get in touch with you, you know, for your guide service, or just follow along on your YouTube or your socials or whatever, anything you want to promote, man, throw it out there.
Yeah. One thing, and this is probably not necessary to clarify, but one thing I just want to clarify quick. I was focused on how there is Cisco on Peck, smelt on Sakakawea. There actually is Cisco on Sakakawea. Mm-hmm. They tend to be bigger. So just, so I don't leave them out. I had that rolling through my mind there, but
yeah, you're all right.
No, I just, appreciate you having me on the show. I listen to a lot of podcasts and ranging from everything from bass fishing to tarpon fishing. And, I listen to you guys the most, and I look up to a lot of the people that you guys have on your podcast, and it means a lot to have me on. So really appreciate you inviting me on. And yeah, one thing, I just want to give a shout out to my buddy, Cody Rowland. We've really been working really hard the last couple of years, and I've learned a lot from him. We've been working at this hard together. So I just had to give him a little shout out.
For sure. Cody.
Other than that, if you want to look me up, you can look up fishcastangling.com. You can look up my YouTube channel, Facebook page, Instagram page, and yeah, I think that's about it.
Right on, dude.